Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Guts and it's the glory, 100 stripes, 100 stories. It's the pledge of allegiance on the 4th of July. It's them handwritten letters from home. It's them sleepless nights alone. It's his newborn baby he left with his wife. Mr. Red, White and Blue, leader.
Welcome back into another edition of the Frontlines of Fantasy. This is episode 2 this week, and we are joined by another special guest. He was a surface warfare officer in the United States Navy. You can find him on Twitter at FF_gouge. His name is Eric Ludwig, and he writes for the Fantasy Footballers. How are you doing tonight?
Oh, I'm doing excellent. How are you?
Not bad, not bad. Can't complain. You know, he's finally getting through some of this coronavirus stuff, and hopefully there's some light at the end of the tunnel. And we are also joined, as always, by Cody Kutzer. You can find him on Twitter at CKutzerFF. How you doing tonight?
Doing all right, man. You know, some of this stuff that's happening in our country right now is kind of weighing heavy on my mind. And just thinking about how this all ties in with you guys, the fact that, you know, we're able to speak out against that and have an opinion against, you know, with that kind of stuff and everything that's going on is thanks to guys like yourself and veterans who help protect those rights. So conversation with everything else going on is for a different time. We're going to focus on, you know, what we have going on right here with you guys. So I'm just excited to learn a little bit more about, you know, the military and service and all that stuff, and kind of build on what we had last week with Kent. So Eric, appreciate you joining us.
No problem. Happy to be here.
Yeah. So again, you know, if this is the first time listening to the show, we decided to start a new podcast. We're interviewing, you know, whether they're analysts, we'll also have some just regular fans on fantasy football, but mostly veterans. And that's what we're looking for. We're going to kind of talk about people's experience, people's journey. You know, if they had fantasy football had any relation to it or not, if not, that's fine too. Something similar to some of the other podcasts we've seen where people interview guys who, you know, how they got their start in fantasy, but this is a little bit different, talking about a subject that doesn't really get talked about as enough. And we're also partnering with the Wounded Warrior Project to raise money for them, which is an excellent cause. You know, some of the stats out there are pretty crazy. They don't just deal with, you know, people who come back and get injured during, you know, wartime or anything like that. They also deal with PTSD and, you know, suicide and depression and all that stuff, which is a real thing. I mean, it's kind of crazy. I was looking up some of the stats the other day, and something that I, you know, maybe shame on me, I should have known some of this stuff, but it's just not something that you really talk about that much. But over 20 veterans and service members commit suicide a day, and nearly 6,000 commit suicide every single year. And so it's a much bigger issue than what I think a lot of people understand. So that's something to me that kind of makes this even more worth it to try to help people out and try to, you know, bring awareness to that, so we can try to start lowering some of that stuff, because it's a little bit it's a little bit sad to know that that's how it is. Actually, more people have died from suicide in the military than actually have died in the war on Iraq. So since 2005. So it's just pretty crazy. I don't want it to be all depressing, but that is something that we're really interested in. So if you can go to our Twitter page, F_authority, and you can donate, whether it's $5, $1, whatever it is, anything helps, and we really appreciate it. With that being said, let's go ahead and just jump into this episode, talk a little bit with Eric. Now, Eric, you were stationed in Mayport like me, but except for you were a little bit different because, well, I guess you were and you weren't, because you were also on the enlisted side. Then you went to the dark side, as they say, because there's sometimes friction between officers and enlisted. But I guess you probably had a better perspective since you started enlisted and went officer, right?
Yeah, definitely. So I actually enlisted in April of 2001. But I didn't go to boot camp until January 2002. So like 9/11 happened in there. So that kind of influenced a lot of my career. But when I enlisted as a nuke electrician. So you actually run a nuclear power plant, and the training for that takes a long time. So like the first segment of that is, well, you go to boot camp, get done with that. Then you go to something called A school, and most A schools are relatively short. Like maybe it's a few weeks up to a few months. Our A school was almost 6 months, and that was kind of like high school level science type stuff and electronics. And then we have power school, which is more like the actual nuclear stuff, the stuff that's classified. That, well, I forgot all that stuff anyways. I couldn't even tell you if I remembered. But after that, you go to prototype. So you actually work on a nuclear power plant. And that's where I applied for the program. It's a pretty cool program. It takes enlisted sailors and sends you to school for 3 years. You get 3 years to get your college degree. And then after that, you become an officer. So like Jocko Willink, well-known SEAL, that's a program that he did. And then after that, I got my commission, became a surface warfare officer, and then went to Mayport so we were actually pretty close together. I think you left like right as I was getting there. Went to the McInerney, which is a frigate. We did two deployments to like South America and Central America to do counter narcotics operations. And then after that, I stayed in Mayport, went to the USS Gettysburg. We did a third deployment to the Middle East, and we're basically kind of like the guardians of a carrier. That's what we did there. And luckily, like, things had really calmed down by then. Like, Iran was still acting up a little bit, but like the stuff in Iraq had really calmed down from a naval perspective. Yeah, it was a pretty interesting time.
So for you, I mean, I know for like as an enlisted guy, especially in engineering, a lot of times sometimes see eye to eye with our like auxiliary officer or chief engineering officer, depending on, you know, for us. How was it for you since, you know, you were enlisted, so you could at least understand some of what we went through as the enlisted people, the more the grunts of the ship who actually do a lot of the work, where how was that relationship for you once you went office?
I think that it was easier to understand where enlisted are coming from, and it's kind of easier to understand like what their concerns might be, but there's still sometimes a clash of personalities, because inherently sometimes enlisted don't want to do certain things, and you kind of have to put on a brave face and you kind of understand what they're saying, but you can't. You know, you have to still say like we got to get this done. That's got to be the focus. There can't be really an alternative. But I think it definitely helped like understanding what was going to happen with them and what they're kind of thinking, what their struggles were. And especially, it still took a little while. Like the McInerney, I struggled with that a little bit, and some of the enlisted sailors, and there's some like personality things. But going to the Gettysburg, at that point, I had a little bit more experience and things worked so much better. Like one of the things that kind of shocked me is one day I talked with our senior chief and I said, you know, what if we just kind of like interview all the enlisted sailors and kind of like, I'm not really quite certain like what their expectations of me are all the time, and see like if there's anything going on that maybe they, haven't brought to our the things that we could help them out with. And I was kind of shocked, like that first question, like, hey, what are your expectations of me? Like enlisted sailors had no idea how to answer that question. Maybe to a certain extent, it was like awkward to say, well, I expect you as an officer and higher in the chain of command to do X, Y, and Z. But they really didn't have any expectations. And I kind of thought that was a shame, because as enlisted sailors be like, hey, you know, I could really use like help in promoting and knowing what I can do to further my career and things like that. And those things normally didn't come up. But the great thing was, it was just by doing that, though, some of the problems. Like one guy, so every time you move from one station to another one, the Navy is supposed to compensate you for like your move, and it's called a ditty move. This one guy had been haggling with the Navy and the paperwork, and like months after he had moved to Mayport, he still didn't have his money. And we had no idea this is the kind of like issue that the sailor was having. But hearing that, like right after that interview, we went into our admin, talked to them, and like within, I don't know, 15 minutes, we have it straightened out. And he got his money paid like the next paycheck. So that, I think that kind of helped, like trying to understand like what's going on with the enlisted mindset.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. While I was on the USS Boone, I had two divisional officers or two auxiliary officers. One, she was great. And I think she really felt like that she like, neither one of them knew anything about like engineering part of it, right? Like, anything that we worked on could understand, like, you know, they weren't gonna be able to come down and assist us with like, you know, troubleshooting something or anything like that. And she understood that. She managed us in the correct way. And like, we had a really, really good, like, so people that don't know, like on, especially on a frigate, you know, engineering department, the engine men are called the A-gang. And so that for us, like we were pretty much in charge of working on everything outside of the gas turbines. We did not touch that stuff. And then there's a couple other things that we didn't mess with, but most everything else was ours. We had four different spaces and we were in charge of most of the equipment that was in there. And so for us, like, we never got time off. We worked probably 15, 16 hour days most days. And whenever, when you come into port and when everyone else is leaving, we're still staying on the ship, working on stuff, getting stuff done and everything else. So it was much difficult than a lot of others. And so, like, our office, like I said, I've had two, and one of them, she was great. She understood stuff. She tried to help us out. The other one, he was like, he was a good guy. Like, actually, like, I'm friends with him today, like on like Facebook or whatever and all this stuff. But like, he was a terrible manager. And like, he was very unorganized. He would come down like in the day, like, 'cause every morning you'd muster up and you'd have a conversation with everything, kind of talk about what you're going to do for that day. And like, all of his papers would be like all crumpled up, and he's really socially awkward and everything else. And like, it just wasn't a great experience. And so every once in a while, he'd try to like tell us what to do on something. It's like, dude, you have no idea what you're talking about. You've never touched any of this equipment. Like, just let us do what we're doing. Like, we're trying to do the best job we can. We're going to make you look good. That's the, you know, to me, that's what my mindset always was. Because when I got there, the most of the, you know, my chief, my first class, they were all like, had been in the Navy for 15, 16, 17, 18 years, really salty, you know, dog sailors, as they call them. And they were much more old school compared to probably what it is now. And that's how I got to learn a lot of respect, because for me, I know one time I mouthed off to my first class and he threw me on the ground. And for a lot of people, they may like think that that's a big deal. To me, it didn't bother me at all. Like, I was like, okay, don't ever do that again. Log that away. And it's just different. But my point is that I think it makes a big difference in the military how your officers deal with you and how they interact with you and how they manage you.
To that point, I think it's kind of weird, understand this from the outside perspective, but as a junior, when you go to the ship, like, you don't know anything. There's very little training that you get going there. And like, luckily I had been prior enlisted. So like, some things like kind of made sense. And so I actually started off in engineering as well. And like, you know, talking about the hours, like, I still remember like it being so special. If I could go home and there was still like the sun out, like it almost never happened. So it was like special each time. And like trying to learn like a certain space, so like engineering to a certain degree, trying to learn like the admin that you have to do, trying to learn some of the paperwork that you have to do. And on top of that, your kind of expectation is that you learn how to drive the ship. And so you're on the bridge. It's almost like you have like three or four different jobs. It's not much preparation to get there. So you're kind of thrown to, they say like being thrown to the wolves. That's kind of how it is. And you kind of have to like find your way and figure out like how your personality can best enable the enlisted personnel in your division. And it's a tough, it's really a struggle. I'd say it took me a good like two and a half years to figure it out. And I had a little bit of a head start because I was prior enlisted.
That makes, you know, that makes sense too. And I know, I think for like, I think some of the disconnect, not well, between officer and enlisted sometimes was that like, we always kind of viewed you guys up in the penthouse because you guys had your own wardroom and all that stuff and all that kind of stuff. So I understand some of that. But like I said, there was quite a few officers that were like, you know, normal every day. Like they weren't, they tried to connect with us and they would come down and BS with us. And we, you know, and so, but then there was a couple that certainly were not that way. And we're not, and probably at times we're a little bit too stuck up, but I guess what is it like, I guess, like in, because there's certain things that obviously I have no idea about, like, you know, just like the wardroom and all that kind of stuff. Like, what is that like? Do you guys, you know, interact every day or, and how, what is that day-to-day life like?
Yeah. So I think it's much more formal than the enlisted life. Like, you know, so on the enlisted mess decks, you know, you get your meal, you sit down, you know, there's really not much formality to it. Like when you go into the wardroom, you have to actually ask permission from like the highest ranking officer in there to like sit down to, you know, start your meal. And you get the same food that the enlisted. It's not like our food is any better, but you like have menus that you like write out what you want for dinner and stuff like that. So if things are same food and everything like that, but things are like way more formal. Before you get up, you ask permission to get up from the senior officer. So yeah, just a lot more formality. And you know, it's like any group. There were officers I got along with like really well, and there are officers I can't stand to this day. It's just kind of the I don't know what it is, but like enlisted, I never really had a problem with any enlisted ever. But like officers are kind of a different breed sometimes, and maybe a little bit of entitlement gets in there with some of them. But you know, it's like any population. You get good ones, you get bad ones.
See, I'm learning stuff too. I never knew that. That's I guess it makes sense on how that is, but like that's crazy. Like that'd be wild. I don't know. Like I don't think I could ever be an officer. I don't think I could ask to get up for ask permission to get up to you know. So I don't know. That is crazy. I guess, you know, learn stuff myself. So yeah, for you, you got done with school and everything else, and then is it you just go straight to a ship after you get done, like once you got done with college and everything else, or how does that work? What is that transition like?
Yeah, so there wasn't like another boot camp or anything like that. The only other officer training I had is once I got accepted into Stage 21, but before I went to college, they do like this. It was really hard to explain. I think part of it was because like that program, Stage 21, wasn't very well funded. There was only a few people that went through it each year before the war. But once 9/11 happened, they needed more officers. So they started getting more people. They kind of like decided, well, we need to have some kind of formalized training. So they created this officer training thing that was supposed to be kind of like boot camp a little bit. But the issue is, and like I was a very junior sailor, but some of the people that were going through there were very senior. So it was kind of like literally having like a chief couldn't be too tough on the chief or, you know, anything like that. So we had first classes and chiefs are going through it. So like they couldn't be too tough on us, but it was supposed to be kind of like a boot camp. But the thing that people don't realize is boot camp is kind of a game. Like I don't know if you realize that, but like going there, you're so scared at first. That first night, I'll never forget like sitting there and thinking, oh my gosh, what did I get myself into? And like everybody has that thought and it's hard to explain it. It's one of those things like you kind of need to be there to understand it. But after a while, that's kind of a game, and things like you can play like it's serious, but you kind of know it's not serious too. But with that like little training before I went to college, like it wasn't very serious at all, and it was kind of a good time, and kind of honestly kind of a little bit of a waste of time. Like I didn't really learn anything there, and anything I did learn that would have been useful, like you go to college for 3 years after that, so you kind of forget that stuff. But you know, it wasn't too formal, didn't learn a whole lot. Like going through college, I had to take ROTC classes, but again, like, you know, a lot of stuff that you learn, you've kind of learned already just going through boot camp and being enlisted. So there wasn't really very much formal training like going out to the ship. So like going out to the ship, like, you know, even with my experience and stuff like that, there was admin I didn't understand at all. And you know, they did teach us like how to do evaluations and stuff like that, but there's still like nuances when you're writing evaluations that we didn't know. So it's just kind of crazy what you expect these people to do without very much training. So yeah, it's definitely a pretty steep learning curve.
Eric, did you know that you always wanted to go and to the officer side, or was that like how does that work? Is that something that you pursued? Is that something that told, like, did someone tell you that's something you should look into? Like how did that come about?
Even going through like A school and power school, they always have like a class leader, and I always kind of wanted to be in the leadership position and just make sure that things ran smoothly. And I kind of realized pretty early on that I could probably affect more change as an officer than enlisted, right? At least I kind of thought that. And so that's true or not true. In the beginning, it's pretty hard to really frankly, they don't trust junior officers enough to have them have much influence over the junior enlisted and senior enlisted. But it takes about like 3 or 4 years before you can really have that influence. But I always knew that I wanted to be there for the enlisted sailors and do as much as I could. And part of it was we had some really good officers in the nuke field. I wasn't exposed to a whole lot, but the ones that we had were really good. So I kind of thought that they were pretty awesome too.
When you got to the ship and you were on deployment and everything, I was like, what was a day-to-day life for you? Because you pretty much stayed up on the bridge, right, and everything else, and that's kind of one of your main jobs. Is that correct? As a surface warfare officer?
Yeah, so it changed quite a bit from my first ship to the second ship. So the first ship, you know, the name of the game as a new officer is getting officer of the deck qualified. So you spend a whole lot of time on the bridge and actually driving the ship. And so on the McInerney, when I did those deployments to South America and Central America, a lot of my time was spent on the bridge. I'd be up there for like, especially us, we were a little bit shorthanded. So I'd be up there for at least 8 hours a day. And we had like some crazy watch rotation where like that, I don't know why our executive officer decided they wanted to kind of play with the schedule. So like if you were on the bridge from like 12 p.m. to 4 p.m., then you would also be on the bridge from 12 a.m. to 4 a.m. And then anytime we had like a port break or something like that, then we'd shift it. So a different watch team would have that shift. And that was pretty brutal because it's not like you're able to sleep like from that 12 a.m. to 4 a.m. You could sleep for a couple hours, but then you had to be up for muster and all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, really start the day off and then hopefully get a little bit of sleep before you had the next watch. Like it was a really weird rotation. So yeah, a lot of my time was doing that. And then The other time was mostly spent with admin type stuff and, you know, making sure that like maintenance was getting done and stuff like that. But really it was more like a learning experience. It wasn't so much leading anything because you're so junior, you don't have a lot of power over anything. It's mostly like learning all the paperwork, all the admin, learning how to drive the ship, learning about other ships and weapons capabilities. The next one was quite different. So I went to school to be a fire control officer. We were the guys that, like, if there's an incoming missile, we have missiles that can shoot down those incoming missiles. We learned to do that. And our ship in particular became what's called the MRADC. So it was Maritime Regional Air Defense Commander. So, like, we had to have knowledge of the entire airspace over the Middle East while we're there. And our primary mission was to protect the carrier. So we're always with the George Washington. And that was quite a bit different. And so I had watch from like, I think it was, no, I'm blanking on it. It was something weird. It was like 3 a.m. to 8 a.m. because they figured like if there was going to be an attack, it'd be in the early morning hours. And we had the same watch every single day. So you can kind of get used to traffic patterns and see when something was a little bit unusual. So and then after that, you know, did some admin and that was pretty much it. So, completely different from one ship to the next. And with that, I should add, so that I didn't do anything on the bridge on the Gettysburg. That was all in what's called combat or a combat information center. So like if you see movies, I know you guys know, but if you see movies and there's like a dark room with a bunch of radars, that's where I stood my watch.
Was it hard not to fall asleep?
Oh my God. So I never drank coffee until that deployment. And then between it being cold in combat, because we were in the Middle East, but it was still like 65 degrees maybe in combat. So I drink coffee to stay warm and stay awake. And I remember this one time, it sounds so weird, but the way the radar worked, you'd have like these sweeps. So you see like the circle going around. And I like must have like daydreamed or something like that. I must have fallen asleep. And I had this image in my head of the XO coming out of the radar screen and starting to yell at me. And so I like woke up from that. I'm like, oh, that's just weird. I need to stand up. Like that was so, yeah, there were definitely some nights. It was pretty, pretty rough in there. It's all dark and stuff like that. So it can be pretty tough.
I'm sure it's a little cool in there too, right? Because of all the radar and everything that's in there.
Yeah. So you have to keep all the electronics really cool. So the AC pretty much pumps in there. So like the bridge was always hot, you know, super hot. Middle East, South America, Central America was always just burning up there. The AC couldn't keep up with it, but the AC in combat, it's kind of the middle of the ship, and it was just freezing in there. I wear a coat, so it's like the Middle East, and I'm wearing a coat. It's kind of weird.
Yeah, yeah. I do remember, like, as like in port, like whenever we stand watch, like we kind of go around and check a bunch of other stuff. We have like a checklist, everything we're supposed to check. And I remember anytime because you go up to the bridge and like at night when no one was up there, when you're on duty and stuff like that, when you're just, you know, in home port or whatever, and like just it always felt like a different world whenever you were up on the bridge because like we never go up there ever. And so like when you just walk up there, you kind of look out at everything and it just like seemed like a completely different world for us because all I ever saw was, you know, the bilge and stuff like that. But or CCOS. But yeah, that's completely different. In terms of like when you guys did on deployment and you guys went to go out, were you guys, I assume you guys probably weren't allowed to get as crazy as we got. I would assume you guys probably had to be a little bit more professional.
It was pretty much like the same rules. And there were definitely like situations that were a little bit more restrictive than others. Like I know we went to the Middle East and it wasn't our ship. There was another ship. It might've been the George Washington. I can't remember, but they had an incident where like one of the sailors had broken a window of a store or something like that. And so like there was almost like a lockdown of the entire, because of that one ship, like all the other ships that were in the Middle East, like they knew they couldn't have another incident like that. So they really locked us down. Like we couldn't drink, you know, in the 3 days we went out. And, you know, you can kind of tell when it's a little bit more tense. And you can honestly, like some places you go to and you can kind of like let loose a little bit. It's more, a little bit more like maybe westernized. And there are some places like, all right, you know, I want to keep it a little bit in check and have my, you could have a good time, but you want to keep your wits about you at the same time, especially like South America. Like, some of the cities were awesome, but some of them were like, yeah, I need to be able to kind of be aware of my surroundings here.
I wish I could say we were not that smart. We were like cavemen and just went out and just got shithoused every time we went. And I actually did pretty good because I went on two deployments. I pretty much did the same thing. Like on the first deployment, we went out and did drug ops. We actually seized, I think it was at the time, it was the biggest seize of cocaine ever in the United States history. We seized like 18 tons of cocaine on our employment. And then after that, we went on the med cruise and we went around. We went to like Scotland and France and Italy and Spain and a bunch of other places. But I do know, like, the entire deployment, one thing I really regretted was not taking more pictures and being more touristy about it. And like, cause like, you know, when are you ever going to get to go over there? But I was 20, 21, you know, I wasn't worried about that. You're on deployment. As soon as you hit a port and you're able to go out, you went out and you got drunk, and it wasn't a healthy lifestyle, I'll say that. But I did pretty good about never getting in trouble, except for I did get in trouble once while I was on deployment. And me and my first class, we decided to have a drinking contest, and I thought I could outdrink him, which was a terrible idea, but like drink faster than him. And we were doing vodka and Red Bull, and I kept losing over and over and over again, like just barely losing. And next thing I know, that's the last thing I remember until I wake up the next morning and my face is all cut up and I have duty that next day. And I'm like an hour late to go to CCOS. I didn't muster in the morning, and I look like just a bag of smashed assholes, right? And I go walking into CCOS, and one of the chiefs that was on duty was in there and was like, "What the fuck, Steele? You shit, what happened? What, do you know what you did last night?" And I'm like, "No, I have no idea. I don't remember anything. It's the last thing I remember." And he's like, "Well, your entire division cannot go out until they sort all of this out." I'm like, "What are you talking about? What happened?" And so I had to go find somebody, and they told me. So basically what happened was I was so drunk, I guess I was sitting there at the bar and I fell over and smashed a table. And so they had to pick me up and they had to carry me. It was 2 miles away. Well, at first they put me in a cab and I guess I threw up. Don't remember any of this. And so they threw me in the cab and they finally get me back to the ship. And then, you know, on the frigate, aft steering is the back of the ship, and they're trying to shove me down into aft steering. And at that very moment, our captain and our XO are walking onto the ship. They scream, "Hey, let go of him. Look, what are you doing?" So they let me go, and I just face plant right into non-skid. And so I don't remember any of this. And so they tell me to take me to medical. And I guess I'm screaming. I'm cussing at our medical, you know, "Get off me. Don't you fucking touch me," blah, blah, blah. You know, just going, losing my mind. Don't remember any of it. Finally, they get me all patched up, and they put me to bed. I don't remember any of this. So I didn't get in like any major trouble or anything. Basically, I just couldn't go out. It just so happened to be the last port that we were hitting before we were going home. So it really wasn't that big of a deal. Other than the fact that we were in Italy, and I really wanted to see like Rome and everything, because we were at Naples. And, but yeah, that was, and then, so of course, me and my big mouth, where I have to like run my mouth all the time. They were, you know, they were mad at me or whatever. And I was like, "Oh, whatever, you know, it's not that big of a deal. I don't care." "Oh, you don't care. You're going to stand two watches." "I don't care. I'll stand all the watches. Give me all the watches. I'll stand all the watches the rest of the day." They gave me all the watches for the rest of the day. And that was the worst day of my life. I was so hungover. I hated my life.
Yeah, I did. Didn't quite do it up like that bad. But I remember there was this one and we were drinking like rum. So that was part of it, like drinking this really good rum. But we also had cigars. And the next day, it was like during a Tiger cruise. So during a Tiger cruise, you can have like family aboard and stuff like that. And they kind of like cruise around the ship for a few days. And so my brother-in-law was on thing. So you're doing shots of rum and smoking cigars and stuff like that. And the next day, I just remember I felt awful. I felt it was like green. It wasn't even seasick. I was just like, let me just get through this day. That was pretty rough. But one of my least favorite things that I ever did was the watch that you never wanted to have. Because you always have like somebody checking like IDs as people come back, checking IDs and making sure that everybody actually gets back to the ship at night. And so you're stone sober, but everybody coming up is just drunk, and a lot of people are like beyond like belligerent drunk, and you're trying to like, you know, and of course they get sometimes aggressive and stuff like that, and you're just like, "Please God, just go to bed. Just go to bed. Don't say anything, just go to bed." And you know, and then there's always like the tension, like, did everybody come back? And it was like standing that watch when everybody was due back on the ship was the absolute worst. It was never a good time. I absolutely hated it.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, no, that's probably, yeah, I'm sure we did. Cause I'm, yeah. I, Because I do remember that you'd come back and you start talking shit to everybody that was, you know, standing on the, you know, quarter deck and everything else. And I can imagine that. Because I remember you see them when we were on duty, and you know, you go outside at the end of the night when everybody's starting to come back too, and they're all like, you just like, get away from me, shut up, you're an idiot, whatever, you know. But I totally get that. Yeah, that's all. I can
understand. Like everybody's freaking out, and then you got all these drunks just hanging, and they just will not go to bed. Like they just want to keep on going. Oh, I was hated that.
Yeah, I got, yeah. I mean, I did a lot of, yeah. Yep. There was a lot of that.
Like, yeah, I get it.
Yeah. But that's the kind of the sad thing. Cause I mean, there's not, you would think that you're overseas, you're traveling. And that's one of the reasons I joined, was to be able to travel. And you would think that you'd want to like actually experience the traveling part of it and like going out and seeing a different culture and all this stuff. But no, the first thing that you just do, like literally, my first day on the ship, right? So when I did A school, and as soon as I got done with A school, it was ridiculous. They sent me to a C school. I'd never even been on a ship, never seen a ship, never stepped foot on one. They sent me to a C school, and like people in the C school were chiefs and first class and second classes. And here's Johnny Boot Camp just walking into this place, having no idea. I'm like, this is ridiculous. I ended up passing it. But anyway, so I met up with my ship, and they were in Panama on deployment, and they had like 2 months left. So I did like two and a, you know, quarter deployments. And, but they, so they're, I fly in, and the first day they're like, you're going out with us. And I'm like, I don't even know these people. I am freaking out. I'm in the Navy, and I, you know, I'm in Panama and all this stuff. So everything's like spinning. I have no idea. I've heard all these stories from these chiefs in first class about how horrible it's going to be and how much they're going to fuck with me, cause you're an A gang and everything else. And all this stuff. And so like, I'm freaking out. So I'm like, okay, whatever you say, let's do it. And the first night they're like, we're going to a whorehouse. I'm like, excuse me, I am 19 years old. I don't know what that is. You know, they don't have those in the States. And yeah, that was my first night on a ship. And yeah, that is, that was my indoctrination into being into A gang.
So one of the things there's a distinct difference between like being a single male on deployment and then like being married. And so what I kind of discovered is that I was married wherever we were on deployments. So I discovered like the best thing to do was to hook up with like people that were married and older. And like, there's a different like level of crazy with that, but like still, you know, there's a couple times when I was some single guys, and you know, we ended up in this one place because in Panama, it's really weird because like these taxi cabs come to pick you up at the pier. And they take you into Panama, but they're kind of, I suspect, like paid or get some kind of kickback, like if they take sailors to like whorehouses or whatever it is. So like this one time, me and a buddy, like we wanted a massage, but like a legitimate massage. Now, like you think like in the States, it's pretty easy to go massage.
Not a happy ending.
Like you it's almost impossible to find. And so we asked for this, and maybe that was a mistake. And they take us to this place, and I'll never forget this. We're sitting in a little room, and there's like maybe like 12 like leather chairs, whatever, surrounding this room, and these girls start coming in, and they literally have a number like on their waist or whatever, and they do like a little turn and stuff like that. And like, oh, you want that one? Like, no, man, I just wanted a massage. Like, get me out of here. This is not what I want at all. That was really awkward, super awkward. And it was crazy.
Yeah, yeah, because that's how it is.
So what we did for massage. They had this really nice hotel in Panama, and they had like a spa. So like that place was legit. So we were able to do that and get like a real massage. But like, yeah, that first attempt was a big fail.
Yeah. Cause I mean, cause the next time we went out too, we were there for 4 days. And so we go to a casino, and so we go there, and you're hanging out, you're gambling, whatever. And like you're sitting there, and like girls will just come up to you, and like, they're like, they act like they're just, you know, like they just want to talk, whatever. So you start talking, whatever, and they're hanging out. I'm like, oh, you want to buy me a drink? And you buy them a drink, and you're thinking like just a normal thing. And then all of a sudden they're like, so it's $100 a night. And it's like, what? Like I was, what is going on here? But that's how it is there. It's a little bit different for sure. Like it was definitely culture shock. Like, okay, this is the Navy. All right, let's do this.
It's a weird thing that like Colombia like exports, and by the way, most of them are not like ugly, like whatever. They're actually beautiful, and a lot of them are Colombian. It's just a different world. Like I can't believe this.
Well, so because from what I mean, what they would tell me is that, I guess, is that because Panama is such a huge port for the Navy that that like women come from like Brazil and Colombia, and they come from all around to come there for that. And so it's different though, because like people think of like, cause they usually go on vacation, like Mexico or like Cancun or all those places. Like when you go to like somewhere like Panama, it's not really so much of a, it's not as much of a destination, you know, for a lot of other places are. And, but it is very cheap to go there. Like when I was there, like it was like, it was like 50 cents, 75 cents, something like that for a beer. It, you know, for a steak dinner, it was like a really nice steak dinner. It was like $6, $7, $8, $9, something like that. And if you were to tip like 10 bucks, like you, something you normally would hear, like you, would have thought you just gave them $100. But so it was nice going out down there because you could go out and have a really good time and not spend very much money. And especially as an enlisted person, especially as like a fireman, it was nice because your money didn't fly out the window really quick, because it was really, because like whenever we did the med cruise and the euro and the pound is so expensive over there, so it was more than what the dollar was, your money flew very quickly. So you had to not live it up as much while you're over there. But when you're in Mexico and all those other places over there, it was a lot easier to actually go out and have a good time.
Yeah, Panama spoiled me a little bit. Like there's this economic term called anchoring. So like if you pay a certain price, you do not want to pay any more than that anywhere else. And I remember in Panama, like we went to this movie and it was like $4 or $5. So in my mind, all movies should be like $4 or $5. And like to pay what we have to, what, $12 to see a movie or whatever it is or more, like that's just outrageous to me to this day.
I can definitely see that. So yeah, I mean, we did. I remember that whenever we were we actually went out into town, like further and deeper into town, and was less out of the touristy part of it. So that was kind of cool. That was probably pretty much the only time that we actually traveled anywhere that I probably actually went and saw anything of like any significance before. Because other than that, that was it. Did you ever go to Scotland? Because we went to, it was right outside of Glasgow, Scotland, twice on deployment when we were over there, and that place was absolutely just beautiful.
Huh. No, we never went to Scotland. We went to Portsmouth, England, and I wouldn't say beautiful, but it was like England's kind of a strange place. It was a pretty fun time, and it was cool. We did some cool things, but like one night, now of course I had duty. One night, like they will just, if they don't have like a holiday, they'll just make one. They call it a bank holiday, and like it was crazy. Like the city erupted, and it was kind of like New Orleans, and like. I forgot this story until just now. So like people would dress up and they would go out in like costumes and stuff like that. So and it was like, so it was kind of like almost like Mardi Gras with costumes, whatever. And I remember seeing this one dude was dressed up as a nurse, and he got into like a drunken fight with this girl, and he tried to kick this girl, and he did it right in front of some English police. So like immediately they take this guy and throw him into the paddy wagon. And I'm just thinking, this dude's going to jail dressed up as a nurse. It was one of the most ridiculous things I've seen. I forgot that story until just now.
Yeah. No, yeah. We never went to England, but so we went to Scotland twice. It was the first place we went to and the last place we went to before we went home. You pull in the pier that you pull into, like it doesn't even look like our ship would fit, like, but you pull in like a cove and like a huge, like green, almost mountain surrounds you. And like it is like the most beautiful thing ever, something you'd see like on TV or something like that. But it that was probably the nicest, or at least just in terms of like scenery, was probably the nicest place ever. There was like a bunch of rocks coming out of the water, like for out, you know, further out and everything else. Like it was a pretty cool place. But I do remember there as well, and there was some local females that were out there on the town, and we tried to like, you know, act like we're American, we're badass, and you know, we can outdrink them. And we lost to these girls, and they put us to shame, and we had to go back. And so in Scotland, like there, like we were allowed to like, you know, do like an overnight shit and stay out overnight. So we got a hotel room and everything else. And this was like probably 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So we had to go back to the ship, or not back to the ship, back to our hotel room. We slept for like 2 or 3 hours and got up and went back out. But yeah, that was.
So what happens is, you know, you develop a certain tolerance, and you kind of know what your tolerance is, and then you go on deployment. So like, you know, you might be out at sea for 2-3 weeks or whatever it is, and your tolerance just kind of goes away. So yeah, any kind of drinking games after you've been out at sea for a while, like a really bad idea, because your tolerance is nowhere near what you think it is.
Yeah, well, it's so like alcohol over there too is not nearly, it's not as like glorified as it is here either. Like they, like legal drinking age is 18. People start drinking much earlier. Most like a lot of these bars stay open like all day. If they do close, it's for a couple of hours to like clean, and then they open back up. Like it's just kind of a different mindset for us, because like I know, like, you know, when you're growing up 18, 19 years old, you know, like you're still illegal, right? And you're not allowed to drink and everything else. So for them, it's a little bit different. But I just remember doing that, and we did shots of. Well, first we're like they're like, well, what do you want to drink? And we're like, yeah, let's do Jack, like, you know, so some real. They're like, you know, that's not manly at all. Like, let's do Jameson. And so I was like, okay, let's do that. And it was not a fun experience because they kicked our ass. I don't know while you're over there. Did you ever try Strongbow? It's a cider beer.
It's a cider, isn't it?
Because that was my first experience. And over there, like, because I know we'd ask the people, like, well, what should we drink over? Because we want to try some, like, you know, some local type of beer and stuff like that. And everyone was like, dude, you got to try Strongbow. And we're like, what is it? And they're like, it's cider beer. And this was like well before like the cider beer craze that like happened a few years ago. And so I was like, okay, we can drink this. Or you drink it and it's like, it's not like super sweet, but it's like got a really good flavor and everything. But you're thinking that, I can get down this stuff. Like this stuff's nothing. Like you, so you're just pounding these things and sitting there and thinking nothing about it. But it's really like 7 or 8% alcohol. And so by the time we got up, like we were feeling pretty strong at that point. And it really catches up to you, but it's delicious. Like, I love that stuff. It's really good, especially over there. Anyways, the whole military is not about drinking, okay? There's more to it than that.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I could handle this. It doesn't seem that bad.
There's a lot of hard work that goes into it. Because I remember on deployment, like, so when you're out to sea, you have like certain pieces of equipment or at least a minimum piece of equipment up at all times. Because like on a frigate, for example, you have 4 diesel generators. And I think you have to have 2 of them up at all time while you're on deployment. It might be higher than that. But we lost two diesels on deployment, and we had to do all this maintenance and all this repairs to them. And we basically stayed up for 2 days straight. We weren't allowed to leave Ox 2 because it was 2 and 3 diesel. And they brought us food down in paper plates, and that's how we ate. And if you were allowed to take a nap in Ox 2, but we had to stay down there because we had to get the diesels back up because we were, you know, on deployment. There was certainly a lot of the phrase of work hard, play hard definitely was in play for us.
Yeah, it always seems to happen where like you're on deployment. And most of it, honestly, is pretty boring. And then there's periods of just like everything goes wrong and it's super hard work, everything back. And like, especially when we were on when I was on the Gettysburg, if we had equipment go down, that was like spy radar and that was, you know, missiles and things like that. And that was not only protecting our ship, but protecting the carrier. So that was a huge deal. If anything broke, like we really had to work hard to get that fixed as soon as possible. So same type of thing. And I know those diesels are brutal, especially as they're aging on the frigates. Those things were constantly breaking down and a ton of maintenance to keep up. But there's cool things about deployments too. I did like Spain. I was able to go on a wine tasting tour and go into the Spanish country, and that at least was like contained and fairly mellow, and stuff like that. But that was really cool. And like I went to Naples as well. So it's like what, like an hour and a half train ride to Rome, and Rome was like the most amazing place I think I've ever been. That was super cool. So
don't tell me that.
Yeah, it was cool seeing those sights.
Yeah, can we hear more? Can we hear more?
Gotta get there.
I was so mad. Like that was the one place we all talked about. Like, okay, we're going to dedicate a day. It's going to be Rome, and we're not going to get drunk. We're actually going to go out. We're going to see everything, and we're going to do everything. And so the first night we were there, we're allowed to go out, but we didn't get there till later. Like, and it was like 4 or 5. So obviously there wasn't going to be enough time for us to go. And then we had to stay and watch. And then the next day we're going to go. And I was not able to go. So all of them got to go. I had to stay on the ship, and they all came back like, oh man, you totally missed it. The Coliseum was absolutely amazing, all this stuff. And I'm like, I hate all of you. It sucks. So that was like the one place I was actually looking for. Cause everywhere else we went to like Toulon, France. We went to Rota, Spain a couple of times. I can't remember everywhere else we went. There was a couple other places we went to, but yeah, so that was like the one place that I was really looking forward to. Wasn't able to go. So
1 day isn't enough. Like for Rome, you need a good 4 or 5 days. There's just too much to see there. Like I didn't see nearly everything I wanted to. And even like some of the stuff that we saw, like the Colosseum, like took a bus there, looked at it for a little while, and like took off so we could see other stuff. So it's not like we're able to spend much time in any place. I need to go back. I want to spend at least 4 or 5 days in Rome alone.
No, for sure. So I guess kind of wrapping up the conversation a little bit, at least on this. What made you decide to want to get out? And whenever you did.
a big part of it was so like finishing up with the Gettysburg, I was up for shore duty this time. And so what they do, I'm sure it's similar with enlisted, is they like give you a list of like, I don't know, 50 or 60 different job openings that there are and say, okay, what are your top, they ask you to list your top 20. But you're able to have a conversation with your captain and say, well, you know, I listed these 20, but I'm really actually okay with these top 8. I don't really want to do anything else. So they work with you in that way. And one of the things that was on this list was recruiting in Buffalo. And I'm from Buffalo. So, you know, I told my wife about this, which is probably a mistake. And she's like, oh, that'd be amazing to go back to Buffalo and all this kind of stuff. And I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll put Buffalo in my top 10. So I literally put Buffalo 10th, and I'm sure I'm the only guy, you know, coming up for that slate that put Buffalo anywhere near their top 10. So they said, you got it. So they sent me to Buffalo. And so like going back to your hometown, it's one thing to leave it the first time when you're initially joining the Navy, but to leave your hometown a second time is tough. Plus we had just had my daughter, my firstborn was born while we were on deployment with the Gettysburg. But my son was born in Buffalo. So now I have two little kids and I'm facing, you know, 5 years of sea duty with a lot of deployments in between those and having, I think my daughter was like, you know, two and a son who's a few months old, like, you know, and being in my hometown, it was just like, all right, that's it. That's enough there. I've, you know, done my time and stuff like that. But just, you know, facing those 5 more years of sea duty with, you know, 6 month deployments and, you know, I, it was one thing to leave my wife, but to leave like two little kids would have been just brutal.
Yeah. I mean, that is one aspect of the military that is super tough is being on deployment and being away from your family. And, you know, not even if wife and kids would be something totally different. Like that would be brutal, especially like a newborn or anything like that. Cause you're talking about a substantial amount of time, like, you know, 6 to 8 months is a very long time to be away, especially from a kid. You know, you miss a lot of stuff, you know, you may miss big moments of their life, their first step, talking and all this stuff. And, you know, you come back, you've been gone for 6 to 8 months. That's a long time. And so those are certain aspects that you really weigh tough. And that's why, like, I mean, the divorce rate in the military is like 75% or something like that. Because it's just brutal and it's tough too. Because when you're out to sea, like it's not like, you know, you get to, you know, you have an argument and you get to, you're going to be able to go home and talk it over when you get home and like, you know, work through it. When you're on deployment, you're out, you know, it's tough. Like there's not, especially back then where your basic communication was email and stuff like that. And the internet wasn't great anyway. And so it was definitely much harder. And I wasn't, you know, married at the time. I dated a girl while I was in, but that was about it. But it's still, it's tough because you can't sit there. And like I would sit there, you talk to people that, you know, had been in for 15, you know, 18 years or whatever, and they have a wife, they have kids. And you can see how much it like, you know, takes a toll on you because, you know, you get in a fight with somebody or they're upset or, you know, and it does happen, you know, cheating and all that stuff that happens in the military. And it can like wreck you because there's nothing you can do. You're kind of isolated in a sense of, you can't do anything about it and you feel kind of hopeless because you can't go out and like, you know, it's not like you can just go home and like talk it over or have a conversation. Like you're stuck there. You're not going anywhere. Right. And so it is brutal in that sense as well. So I think that is probably one of the biggest reasons why people end up getting out is because of that, because of how hard it is on a relationship.
Yeah. It's easy to like lose context when you're emailing back and forth. Like it's so easy to lose any kind of context. And like on the ship, you don't really have – we had a phone, but it was always broken. So you couldn't, like, call home or anything like that unless there's, like, emergencies. We had a satellite phone you could use. But, you know, those are kind of extreme circumstances then. And so now you're only talking to your wife, whatever, like, once every few weeks when you pull into port and, you know, connections are terrible and all this stuff. It's just tough. And I saw, like, a lot of enlisted sailors that, you know, they were having problems at home or, like, you know, their wife was draining bank accounts or – not paying bills and there's problems and there's really so little that they could do.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, we were lucky. I mean, I don't remember our phones being down that much. We had them, but you had to have like a calling card to be able to do it. And so like you couldn't talk for very long. It's not like you're going to sit there and have a 30-minute conversation. And there's usually 5 or 6 people waiting to use the phone. So if you're able to use it and you get in line, because you don't want to wait that long because time is precious because you basically, when you're on deployment, you work all day, you do your job, you do all the stuff you're supposed to do if you don't have watch. And if you stand a night watch, you try to go to bed so you can get a little bit of sleep in between because then you're going to be up for another 4 hours to stand watch. And then usually, but if you stand like a night watch, by the time you go to bed, you're going to get maybe a couple hours. You're going to have to wake right back up because you have to be up at I don't know, 6 a.m., something like that, to get up, eat breakfast if you want to, and then you have to go work the rest of the day, and then you probably have a watch and stuff like that. So time is very valuable when you're in the military, especially on deployment, because, you know, you want to sit there and you maybe sit down and watch a little bit of TV or something, play some video games and stuff like that. But you don't have a lot of time to be able to sit around and do a lot of that stuff. So it is tough, and that is one of the things I regret getting out. Because I wouldn't have, like, you know, my kid and, you know, my wife and everything else that I have. But I do miss it. And I was, like, so close from reenlisting. I actually had everything, told them to make up all the paperwork for me to reenlist. I was going to reenlist. And then I was just an idiot. And I think something happened. It pissed me off. I'm like, you know what? Screw this. I'm not reenlisting. I'm getting out. And I regret it. Like, literally, I was home for 2 weeks. And I was like, man, I shouldn't have got out. That was stupid. I should have stayed in. But, you know, especially now that I look back, man, I'd have like 4 years left and I'd be retired, you know, but it is tough. And I understand that. So that is another aspect to it that a lot of people, you know, don't really think about, because all those little things can really add up and stack up on top of you.
Yeah. And a lot of times when you look back on something, you only remember the best parts and the good parts and not so much the bad part. And so I always thought it was funny, like people who hadn't gone to sea or hadn't gone to deployment for a while. And then they would come back and they'd be kind of excited for the deployment. And then after a few weeks, they'd be miserable again, like, oh, I forgot how much this sucked. But yeah, there's some really cool parts about it. But I don't regret getting out, just because of what was going on with my life and you know, what's transpired since then. And especially I can't imagine like leaving my kids when they were, especially because they were that little. And you know, I was worried, like, literally if I left for 6 months, I don't think my son would have known who I was when I got back. So, you know, it was a fairly easy decision. I had, you know, done my time and I was happy with my decision. It is weird though, seeing friends who continued on and now they're close, like you said, to retirement. You know, they're close to retirement, or like, you know, one guy's a captain of a destroyer out in Japan, stuff like that. So it's pretty cool, like seeing some of the people that you served with like progress that far.
No, for sure. Actually, a guy that we joined at the same time. We both got out. We were both E5s, and he made chief in seven and a half years, which is almost ridiculous. Like, that is about as quick as you possibly can do it. And he's now a senior chief. And yeah, he has 4 years left. So it is a little bit crazy to see, to watch and kind of that transpire. Most people I served with got out. There's still a few people that I served with that are still in. And like I said, he's in Norfolk right now. Anyways, I think that's enough story time for I could tell so much more. There's so much more that happened that, but I'll save that for another pod, so I don't throw all my bad shit out all at once that we did.
It's funny, like I'm getting older now, so I'm like, there's so many stories that I forget, and then something happens, like, oh, I remember this really funny story of this thing that happened where, but you know, like,
But before we wrap this up, because we're going to have a little fantasy talk before we do this. I mean, this is a fantasy football, you know, show. So, you know, or a fantasy football site. So anyways, let's jump in. Let's do a little bit of fantasy before we wrap this up. We're just going to kind of ask the same kind of questions, kind of basic stuff. But who is one player you want to come away with in every draft?
The guy that I'm getting almost everywhere is Tony Pollard. So there's really no guarantee there, but he was actually usable, and especially because I'm doing a lot of best ball drafts now, he was actually usable in some weeks last year. And he's so cheap now. He's going in like the last rounds that I just love him, and I love his upside. But, you know, with that, like similar guys like Kareem Hunt, Alexander Mattison, but yeah, Tony Pollard, I'm just looking at my best ball teams, and he's like every single one of them. So that's definitely a guy. But you know, what I was talking about is, like, I do a bunch of different drafts, so I kind of have different answers depending on what kind of draft it is. So I've done, like, a couple of Dynasty rookie drafts, and the rookie I love, Donovan Peoples-Jones. So he's going real late. Not many people know him. He was a five-star recruit coming out of high school. We went to Michigan, and their passing game was just pretty awful. And he was drafted pretty late by Cleveland, so he's going pretty late. But I kind of wonder if he won't develop in 2 to 3 years. So that's another guy that I just – almost every time we're doing a rookie draft, I get him super, super late, like fourth, fifth round type guy.
Yeah, he's free, man. And there's always it always seems like Odell was the talk of possible trade rumors. And I can't exactly remember what Jarvis's contract situation is like. So if he just sits there for a year or two, you know what I mean, kind of develops and learns and he can grow into that offense, that's, like you said, he's free. And he has enough intrigue around him with, you know, with his I mean, at this point, like, it's hard to look and be like, well, he was a five-star, so, but, like, that does carry some weight, and then, obviously, he blew up the combine and everything, so he's one who is definitely worth a stash, especially if you have, like, a taxi squad that you can just kind of sit him there and let him chill for a year.
Yeah, I looked up the contract situation, too, so it looks like Jarvis Landry is there for, like, I think it's, like, two or three more years, pretty much. They're not getting away from that contract. But I think it's next year that Odell, they can get away from that contract and it's not going to cost them anything. So like you said, he's just a project. There's no guarantee there, but he's just so cheap now and he might run into opportunity. But I think a lot of these like rookie wide receivers were looking for immediate production, but you really have to think about like what's going to happen in 1, 2, 3 years. And you know, give these guys a chance to develop. And there's so many good wide receivers in this class that I'm kind of taking like just a numbers approach, like get as many of them as I can and just hope a couple of them pan out.
Yeah, that makes sense. So give me your top sleeper for 2020.
My guy that I really like is Anthony Miller. So he started to come on strong last year, dealt with some injuries. But I think it's kind of funny because I don't know if you guys remember this, but going into last year, Deed Westbrook was a popular sleeper because, well, Nick Foles, he targets the slot receiver and all this kind of stuff. And now Nick Foles, he's got a pretty decent shot starting for Chicago. So Anthony Miller is a guy I've been getting quite a bit of too.
I like that call. He was killing it at the end of the year there. And he's been someone that I've liked since he came in his rookie year. So I think it's a really good call. And I think he's going like 11th, 12th, 13th round. So he's going pretty late, even with, and normally whenever we see guys like that tear it up at the end of the year, that tends to carry on into drafts the following year. And for some reason, it's just not with him.
No, I agree. And I think he's somebody as well that I think this offense takes a step forward this year with Nick Foles. So I like that call too. Like he's somebody that we've been kind of waiting to pop. And you know, sometimes it takes wide receivers. We've certainly seen flashes from him. And so I think this is definitely the year they could put it together. I mean, who else? What's the other target competition there's there anyway outside of Allen Robinson, right? So I think this is definitely the year that he could end up being at least a wide receiver three. So and then the last one, I want a ridiculously bold Melcher face-off prediction for the 2020 Ooh, season.
A ridiculously bold one. Well, my very bold prediction was going to be that Calvin Ridley and Julio Jones finish as top 12 wide receivers, but I don't know if that's ridiculously bold. I guess if I have to go ridiculously, like melt your face off, I say Matthew Stafford finishes as QB1, overall QB1.
There we go.
He was on pace for 5,000 yards, and I think 3,000 yards last year. He's certainly got the weapons this year.
No, for sure. Everybody hates Matt Stafford. Every year this is what happens. People are like, it's Matt Stafford. I don't care. You grab him late in drafts. But like the dude is solid almost every single year. If he had it, and the pace he was on last year was ridiculous. So I like that call a lot. And that's one reason, you know, liking, you know, guys like Kenny Golladay and Marvin Jones, who is criminally undervalued every single year. He was on pace as well for what, 1,100 yards and like 10 touchdowns, something like that last year. So
I just saw a tweet about that. I wish I could give credit to whoever it was, but they showed like the 16 game pace for both those wide receivers. They're both over 1,000 yards and both, I think it was like both 11 touchdowns, something like that.
I saw that too. I can't remember who put that out, but the numbers were super similar, like really similar.
And there's a massive difference between where they're going. I think Marvin Jones is like 9th, 10th round and Kenny Golladay is going like the 3rd round. So, yeah, I think people are undervaluing Marvin Jones a little bit. Anyways, all right, I love that call as well, Matt Stafford and QB1. I like, or the QB1 for that.
So, that had to be like the melt your face off, like, you know, nobody's really talking about that. So that's, I don't think it's actually going to happen, but I think he's going to put in a solid season.
Yeah, I mean, I think top 5 upside certainly there with the weapons they have with Golladay and Jones, and then TJ Hockenson, we can take a step forward and what they've done with the running game. So, no, I like that call a lot. So, anyways, so I really appreciate you coming on. I just want to, you know, tell you I really appreciate it and appreciate your service and, you know, everything that you did. Have a little bit better appreciation for officers now. Not that I hated officers, but, you know, there was always a little bit of a, you know, a difference in opinion on certain things. But, hey, you know, you learn stuff all the time. And I really appreciated, you know, hearing your story.
Yeah, well, you know, so thankful that you're starting this up, because I think it's pretty awesome to hear people's stories and what they kind of went through and parts of their military life. And Wounded Warrior Project, that's awesome. You're supporting that too. So love that.
Yeah, no problem. And I love talking about this stuff, and I like hearing people's stories. So there's a lot more to come. Believe me, there's a lot more debauchery in my life that I did over those 4 years that I'm just scratching the surface. Don't want to let it all out in one night. So anyways, but I really appreciate you coming on. You can find him on Twitter at FF Gouge. I don't know. I was about to say Gage. Anyways, Eric, I really appreciate you coming on, and we will see everybody again next week. Peace.
Craig is usually a fan of water cooler talk, but it's draft season, and that's all anyone wants to talk about. The Athletic has loads of articles about this year's draft, but Greg doesn't have The Athletic, so now he's filling up his water bottle in the bathroom sink, which, to remind you, is the sink people use after they use the bathroom. Get The Athletic and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.